When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth interviews comedian Wyatt Cenac, who also takes a few more questions backstage just for this podcast. Then you'll hear a new edition of Late Night Chats, featuring late night staffers Amanda Cowper and Michael Whiteman. But first, let's hear Seth and Wyatt Cenac.
Our guest is an Emmy-winning writer and comedian you know from The Daily Show and the TBS series People of Earth. His new late-night show, Wyatt Cenac's Problem Areas, premieres Friday night on HBO. Please welcome back to the show, Wyatt Cenac. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Before we get started, I owe you this. I was doing a little weekend work driving Uber.
And
I had a fare.
Yep, okay.
And then I was like, oh, great, I got a good fare. Gonna get a little dinner money. Then they were like, the fare canceled. I was like, sweet, a free 10 bucks. And then I just heard that I gotta give you that 10 bucks back.
Yeah. And a little interest.
Well, no, I need change.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. We'll leave it here. We'll sort it out when we're done.
Right. Yeah.
So your new show is a talk show, but you travel around the country and you talk to people outside of New York, all over the country. Have you enjoyed flying around? Have you enjoyed getting out there?
I have enjoyed flying around. I am a little bummed out because when I started, I figured like, oh, this will be great because I use HBO's money to bump up my Delta SkyMiles status.
Right.
No.
You didn't move the dial at all?
I started flying before the end of the year, and then none of that transfers over. So I'm still back in, like, steerage class.
I'm so sorry. Do you feel like it's an unfair system, the mileage system on airplanes?
It's a horribly unfair system, because here's the other part of it, is, like, sometimes when they screw up, they're like, oh, yeah, we'll give you some miles. And you're like, oh, great, I'm that much closer to, like, gold or diamond or something. And then they're like, oh, no, those aren't miles for that. They're, like, these other miles that don't actually go towards your status. They go to the Delta gift shop. Or you can buy a neck pillow for, like, oh, yeah, that's going to be 30,000 miles for an inflatable neck pillow you probably could have got at Costco.
Do you feel like there's a fix? Do you have a fix for the mileage program?
So my issue is I fly Delta a lot, and then every now and again I'll fly American or United or places where Delta doesn't go. And then I get miles for, like, these airlines I'm not using, and I feel like there should be some sort of stock exchange where I could take those United miles and trade them for Delta miles. Like, right now, I bet you there are some of you who you all have, like, Delta miles that you don't use because you're like, I'm a Spirit Airlines person. I don't know who you are. You've made some interesting life choices. But if I had, I don't think Spirit Airlines gives points. I think they just give cigarettes. But I don't know, if I had three cigarettes, I could trade you those three cigarettes for, like, I don't know, 40,000 Delta miles. That feels like a good trade-off.
That does seem like a good trade-off.
Yeah.
So you're traveling around, and you're trying to find solutions to problems big and small in this country. What are some of the problems that you have discovered in your travels?
I mean, I think the first one is that Delta won't give me.
Yeah, sure.
I think that's the whole season of the show is really just me trying to shame Delta into bumping me to diamond status.
Yep, that's a good one.
But then there are other things. We, as you saw in the clip, we are looking at policing in America, and part of going around to different places in the country is looking how that relationship between police and community exists in different cities around the country. Because, you know, when we talk about that divide that exists between police and community, you know, we talk about it nationally, but it's all local stuff. Like, it's all, you know, what happens in New York isn't necessarily what happens in L.A. or in St. Louis or in, you know, some small town in Oklahoma. So it felt like, oh, why don't we go to these places and see what it looks like in these places, but also as they deal with issues, what are the solves that they find? What are the things, how are they addressing it? Because maybe there's something that you could learn from, like, oh, that's how they're doing it in this small town in Oklahoma? That seems like it's not a half bad idea. Yeah, why can't we do that? Like, are you trying to say Oklahoma's better than us? That's really what I want to do, is just try to create some weird caste system between cities and states where it's like, wait a minute, you're saying Lawton, Oklahoma's better than New York City? Screw that, we're going to war!
You do stay true in a separate project to your Brooklyn roots. You have a show called Wyatt Cenac, AKA, where you play a superhero.
AKA Wyatt Cenac, yes.
Where you play Viceroy.
Yes, I play a local Brooklyn vigilante. It was a web series. We got nominated for a Webby.
Do you win? Oh, you don't know yet.
I don't know.
Yeah, the Webbies
yet.
Haven't happened yet.
No, so yeah, we got nominated for a Webby. But I think we'll probably lose to Jay-Z.
This is, though, I don't know, because Jay-Z does a lot of badass stuff. This is the Viceroy in Brooklyn fighting artisanal mustard.
Yeah, that's, you know, as a Brooklyn-based vigilante, it's not as though, you know, some of the crimes are your more gentrified crimes.
I don't know. I think you're going to give Jay-Z a run for his money. And congrats on the new show, man. It's always such a pleasure to see you.
Great to see you.
Wyatt Cenac, everybody. Wyatt Cenac's Problem Areas premieres Friday night at 11:30 on HBO.
Hey, this is Henry from Late Night. I'm here with Wyatt Cenac.
Hello.
So on this new show, you're just talking to Seth about how you go around the country and talk to people. You're doing essentially like this documentary series around the country. At The Daily Show, you also did a lot of field pieces and talked to people, but in character.
Right.
How did The Daily Show experience translate into Problem Areas?
I think part of the translation, you know, the way that we did things, the way that we thought about telling stories, there's definitely an element of going in, and that approach is thinking about all of the elements we need to properly tell a story, whose stories we're telling. Where things kind of diverge is with The Daily Show, we often walked out with a fully formed idea that this is a story that we want to tell. With this, I'm a little more curious about things, and the stories they're more open. We're more open to the variables. So as we're going and we're sort of interviewing people and we're talking to people, what we found a lot of times is that, oh, the story's slightly different. The story's changed in ways that we didn't necessarily, we weren't expecting. And so in that way, there's something that's kind of nice about it, because it creates this sort of organic thing that becomes part of the journey that then takes us into the editing process and everything. Uh-huh. So, yeah.
And were the stories kind of evolving from like before you went, while you were there, and then editing to air?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, when we first started, like I said, when we first started, my head writer, Hallie, and I, we kind of blocked out, okay, we think these are 10 episodes. We want to cover this, and this. Mm-hmm. And then as we then started putting the stories together, it was, okay, where can we go? Who will give us access? Uh-huh. And that all changes. And then we go and we shoot stuff. And then it's, oh, the story evolves in this way. And then once you come back, especially doing stories about policing, you know, stories change all the time. As something makes headlines, now all of a sudden it turns into this thing of, is that story something that is a part of one of the stories we're telling? Mm-hmm. And if so, how do we incorporate that in a way that both maintains the integrity of our story and that moment, that thing that has perhaps entered into public consciousness as a news story.
Right. And on top of all that, it's a comedy show.
Right.
Yeah. How challenging was it to bring comedy into these stories on policing, which is inherently not a typically funny story?
There's definitely a challenge, but I think for me going into it, I didn't go into it with the same approach as I would go into a Daily Show field piece. So I think a lot of the humor, there's humor that, you know, in sort of setting up these things and then going into the world, I think a lot of the humor is sometimes looking at the ridiculousness of the current state of policing in America and the current relationship, and then meeting people who are trying to do something different. I think there's a sort of kinship in, all right, you all are trying to do something different. Isn't it ridiculous what currently exists? And so it definitely was a reframing for me in some ways in approach.
Yeah. And then finally, I'm just wondering, you live in New York, you lived in LA for a bit, you also grew up in Dallas. I'm wondering what kind of, for this project, traveling around the country taught you about America that you maybe didn't realize from the quote polarized coasts, these East Coast liberal elite coasts.
I feel like there's more common ground, and it'll sound trite, but I feel like there's more common ground than people, at least on television and in the national conversation around things, often give Americans credit for. I think at the end of the day, no matter what city I found myself in, you know, these stories that we were telling are stories of people who are just trying to have safer communities. They're just trying to find answers that, you know, to be able to feel safe in their homes, safe in their communities, safe on the street. And so I think that it doesn't matter whether that person was black or white or Native American, whether you're talking about city council people, law enforcement people, community activists, there is this common ground that exists. What it feels like the challenge is sometimes when the sort of the intensity of the national conversation gets so loud that they sometimes can't hear one another.
Totally. Well, it's such a unique show and a special show, and I'm so happy it's premiering this Friday. Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you
very
much.
I'm so excited to see more of it. It was such a pleasure having you here.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Thanks, man.
All right. Now let's eat all these snacks. There's a bunch of snacks in here.
Yeah, there's some nuts, apricots, some fruit,
you probably,
crackers.
You can't see them because it's a podcast, but here are the nuts.
This is that exclusive backstage content I think people are psyched about.
Hi, this is Amanda Cowper. I'm the associate producer at Late Night.
And I'm Michael Whiteman, and I'm a production coordinator here at Late Night.
And this is Late Night Chats with Amanda and Michael.
Hey, Amanda.
Oh, hi, Michael.
Funny seeing you again. It's been all of 30 seconds since we were back-to-back in the office. So now we're facing each other in the conference room.
We're the production team du jour from our production wing. We're the production thing from the production wing. We have a hallway that is us, Jen Sachko, and...
I like to call it the West Wing because it technically is the most western part of the office, and I like to think that all of the most important decisions are made in the West Wing. You, me, accounting, everybody. We're all like, where the money originates. We're the Wall Street of the Late Night office.
They literally couldn't do the show without us. As we were introducing our titles, I realized that probably most people don't know what associate producer or production coordinator necessarily means. I mean, associate producer could mean about 3,000 different things. I mean, sometimes associate producer is like, oh, someone who gave money to like an indie movie. In the news world, it's like a step above PA. And associate producer here, I do all the field remote shoots. So I've been doing that since the beginning when I met Michael.
When we met each other on the first day of work, when I was our receptionist, which is I feel like kind of like a misnomer as far as titles go at this show. Not that there isn't a reception element involved in that, but it's not. I feel like there are receptionists at nail salons and like massage parlors, and at our show the receptionist is kind of like the mayor of a small town. There's a lot of expectation, a lot of complaints, a lot of things on their table, but absolutely no power whatsoever. Kind of like Tut the boy king, like everyone's coming to you with like their gripes and you're like, yeah, like I totally agree with you, but I answer the phone and put out the Werther's Originals, so I don't know what. Now I have a vague semblance of what Amanda's job was back then, so we both come a decent way.
Right, and those early days, starting a new show with a whole bunch of other people, Mike Shoemaker, Hillary Hun, they had been at Fallon, they had started that show, but most of us were new to it, and no one knew where to go, what to do, so Michael and I was the production coordinator when we started. I mean, it was just every day was like a million questions. And we bonded.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It was like the Wild West. I feel like there were like 12 people in the office for those first few days and mm-hmm. or those first few weeks, months, and then slowly seeing it grow. And now we share basically like a third class cruise cabin size office together. So to think back to the first days when it was just like tumbleweeds blowing through the office, I secretly long for those like pre-air days when it's just so much room like that. I feel like there's a lot that you learn too sharing a space with somebody that's about 4 square feet.
We need to iterate to the people at home. I think that if Michael, who's a tall gentleman, reached out both of his arms, he could probably touch both sides of the walls of our office that we share. And this is no complaint. We love our desks, our life together.
They're wonderful.
We're very good roommates. But it is, I'm so glad that everyone keeps their smells to themselves. And lunch smells, post-lunch smells. Everyone's very polite.
I mean, Amanda, I feel like the job that I have now has probably changed quite a bit from what from when you were there. What's the hardest part of your job now?
My job now? When I started, I was the production coordinator, and I did a lot of things that Michael does, a lot of like paperwork and release forms and just all the parts of production that no one wants to think about but exist regardless. And now I'm in charge of the field shoots. And I would say the hardest part is, I guess, when we get really, really busy. We have a small but mighty field department, and sometimes like a lot comes in. Like, for example, we just did a newspaper movie. It was originally called Journalism Movie, and we were in the middle of it, and it was huge. It was epic. We had this enormous set, and we had an exterior day coming up the next week, and I got a call when we were setting up that we had a shoot with Kelly Clarkson in 5 days. And they wanted it at a fancy restaurant, or fancy bar, rather. It was day drinking with Kelly Clarkson, and it was the best challenge. I mean, my adrenaline was crazy because we had to accommodate this big star and while putting on one of the biggest shoots we've ever done. And that is like such like a job interview question. Like, the hardest part is the best part. It's the challenge of doing something that it doesn't feel impossible, but feels like you this has to be really good or it doesn't work, and you have to do it fast. And that's the part about field shoots that I love so much. When we get to like, the idea came in this morning, we shoot it this afternoon, it's on air that night. We just did that with Spring with John Lutz, going outside in the cold. Now, you skipped a job in between receptionist and production coordinator.
I did.
You were?
I was our audience coordinator. I'm definitely the only person to have had more than two jobs. A lot of people mm-hmm. have been, you know, they're like experts in their field, and I feel like I have been like, I've moved into other positions. I've been fortunate enough to have the opportunity to do that. And my second job was audience coordinator, which is one of those jobs that you don't even realize exists in TV, because so few shows now are actually shot in front of like a live studio audience. And the jobs that do have that are typically on like Los Angeles back lots in those studios, and doing it here in 30 Rockefeller Plaza, like elevatoring up, you know, 200 people every night to our studio, and with the pages and everybody and security, and getting to work with all those wonderful people was such a challenge. And especially, my God, when we took the show to Washington, D.C. for a week and did the Warner Theater, sold it out for an entire week at almost 2,000 seats. That was a physically exhausting sort of deal. So two different sort of ends of that spectrum.
And of all three jobs, can you think of like a favorite rewarding moment that you had?
I don't know. It's hard to find like a particular moment that is super rewarding. I mean, every day just kind of has like those things where, oh, this is actually like the job that I get to do. I mean, I do specifically remember, though, once we had finished with all of our DC shows, you know, had the vice president on and everybody, it'd been like pretty much a week of like 10 days of all-nighters, just constantly being up, dealing with tickets. It was such a monumental scale. And being in the bar of that JW Marriott when we had our impromptu rap party. I know this isn't true, but in my mind, Bruce Springsteen's Glory Days was just playing on repeat. And I don't know if I've ever had that much to drink in my life, but it was a true celebratory moment. I think we all realized, like, our small team of people who were working in that audience really batted out of our league on that one. So we were very, very pleased.
I'd actually love to tell my most rewarding story. You just reminded me. In D.C., we shot at the Pentagon, and one of our bits was this portrait of the Secretary of Defense Ash Carter. They had stopped doing portraits because of money. Anyway, we made one with Ash Carter's head on a Arnold Schwarzenegger body. So we were on our prep day, and the person who was helping us out said, hey, do you mind if like so-and-so comes in here and takes a look? And they'd come in and they'd laugh and they'd leave. And a couple hours later, she was like, hey, can this group of guys come in and take a look at the portrait? And I said, of course. And they came in and they were a little gray-faced and they were serious. You know, we're in the Pentagon. And they left laughing so hard, so hard. They turned and they were like, oh my gosh, that made our day. And the woman looked at me and she said, thank you so much for doing that. They had a really hard morning dealing with something in Afghanistan, and you really changed their day. And like working here, working in an isolated place where you don't, especially in field shoots, you don't get like even necessarily like audience feedback, to have comedy having a direct impact on changing someone's day is like the thesis statement for my career. It was the best moment I could imagine having.
So one of the many great things about working here at Late Night is that we get these wonderful things called hiatus weeks, where the show isn't taping and we're free to do as we please. Do you have anything fun planned for our next one?
Well, I'm really excited because a project that I directed is premiering at Tribeca Film Festival.
Oh, very exciting.
At the Tribeca Now Showcase. Now stands for New Online Works. So it's the second year in a row that something I've directed has gotten in, which toot toot beep beep, my own horn. I'm very excited about it. And those hiatus weeks are really a blessing for creative people who are on the staff who want to do something outside of it. And the best part is when Robert De Niro personally chooses your project to display at his renowned film festival. And to tell like Shu and Seth to be like, hey, this outside thing happened. And like the first time I did it, I was like, I was nervous that like they would be somehow mad that I did it on a Saturday or on, you know, one of our weeks off. And they couldn't be more supportive and like excited.
That's awesome. That's amazing.
Are you doing anything cool? You write on the side?
I do, but I feel like that's like a, you know, you're a director, a producer. Like I like to write more than anything. So I feel like that's kind of, it's more of like a, you know, a personal solitary sort of thing. And it's funny, like, two people to share an office, like every night the show's over and everyone's leaving. And I feel like I'm always like, ugh, like ready to go home and like catch up on TV and like binge something on the couch. And no matter like what happened that day, I feel like you were always off to do something like cool until like late at night in like some like rented warehouse. For two people who get along so well, I feel like we have extremely different outside of work existences.
Yeah, since you can't see us, Michael lives on the Upper East Side and is wearing a Patagonia vest right now, and I have bangs and I live in Brooklyn, so we're perfect strangers, like an odd couple.
Like I'm an indoor cat, like you're
a warehouse cat.
Yeah, we're warehouse cat, a jungle cat, you know, mountain lion. Uh-huh. I think we have two, but we know we do manage to work well together.
We do. So every night when we watch the show, we have lots of thoughts and opinions as we watch The Closer Look.
I think your friends and people you meet because they find out you work at Late Night think that you're automatically like qualified to be at, like, in the McLaughlin group. Like you just have that your opinions are just a notch above other people's. So I feel like we have the political acumen and the that cachet to really have, you know, the media liberal East Coast elite.
My therapist grabbed me a few days before the election and said, will Trump win?
And you probably said no.
Because she looked at me like as an authority figure. I said, no, never. It'll never happen in our liberal elite bubble. Anyway, I have some questions here about what we would do if we were in charge.
If we were the everyman who was elected.
All right, let's get into these questions. Speaking of Trump and all the horrific things that have happened, if I had gotten into hot water, which I totally would. Like, who would Olivia Pope me? I would say Hallie.
Here on the staff?
Here on the staff.
Hallie Raff, our producer and head of our talent department.
The way I hear her on the phone, and she's so nice and so cool and wears the best outfits and has amazing hair, but she also, like Olivia Pope, but she can do anything on the phone. She's like Roy Cohn from Angels in America. She can do anything.
Having spent, like, a year or year and a half as an audience coordinator, seeing Seth take questions from the audience every night, people would ask him some of the craziest questions you can even imagine being asked, and without even a beat, he would have an answer and something quick, witty, and that would immediately answer the question, make everybody laugh, and move on. Like, I mean, I know it's like cliche to like say the boss, but mm-hmm. honestly, like if they said that Reagan was Teflon, like Seth is Teflon's like 21st century brother, because I feel like he could spin anything.
That's good. Who should we hire at Late Night since all these people have left Trump's administration?
Which jettisoned Trump lackey would we? I mean,
jettisoned.
I feel like, I would have to say, like, if the show ever found money and was stupid enough to hire me an assistant, I would want Anthony Scaramucci. Like, I think
the mooch
would be, you know, like 11 days as a White House advisor is pretty great. But also, like, he's a Harvard guy. He's smart, but he also has that anger that you see from, like, bus drivers that...
He's got a lot of street in him.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he has, like, a lot of street, but he's also got, like, the blue chip education that you were like, oh, like, this guy could kill with his mind and his fists. Like, he, like, motions to waiters to come closer, you know? Like, he's, like one of those guys, like, locks and, like, motions.
Absolutely,
like, he's like that, or, like, grabs him by the lapel. Like, he gets the job done.
You love presidents.
It's my favorite thing. I feel like working in Late Night will be my step one of moving into politics.
Michael actually teaches me presidential factoids all the time. And the one that I love, like, I'm like a child at his feet. Like, tell me the story about the one who talked until he died.
No.
What was his name again?
That was William Henry Harrison.
Yeah, I think I'd love to have him as, like, a guest on our show, just to see how deftly Seth could handle somebody like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Harrison would be a great guest. I don't know if he'd be a good host, though. Who's the host?
It's television, let's be honest. JFK. Like, who else do you want to, like, look at every night for an hour? Seth Meyers, handsome man. JFK, handsome. Like, I want to see handsome.
Warren G. Harding, though, probably the most handsome. Had a love child that was conceived in a closet. And I think the
a love
White
child
House,
that
love
was
child.
Conceived in the closet of the White House.
I believe so. Yeah,
you heard it here first.
Or maybe just a closet. Maybe there was, like, a follow up concept. But he definitely Warren G. Harding, Teapot Dome scandal, White House perhaps poisoned by his wife on a cross country train trip because of you guessed it, said love child.
Okay, that's exciting. That's an exciting host. You never know what you're going to get. What would be your presidential campaign slogan?
As a diehard West Wing fan, I would have to say, "Let white men be white men."
Ooh, in 2018, I'm not sure if let white men be white men.
Oh, white men for America.
I think we may have to change your last name if you run.
Maybe M-Jack for America.
Yeah, that sounds sturdy.
Sturdy, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, what would your campaign slogan be?
Oh, brother. Like, I'm just happy to be here. Like, yeah. Like, thanks, everybody, for your time and your attention. I don't have the cojones for mass leadership. I cap it at, like, a state. So if I were to be, like, a governor. My governorship would be more vending machines in the cafeteria.
If I were running against you, I would spin that and say more vending machines. Oh, are you against the worker? Do you want pro-automation? You know, I feel like your job is very cool that you get to produce these field shoots. Oftentimes we have celebrities on these field shoots. Mm-hmm. Which celebrity would you like to endorse you?
Well, because we recently hugged and because we have the same birthday, Kelly Clarkson, today, yesterday, and forever. She is a shining star. Up on high. I'm going to say just Kelly, she sings, she's warm, she does it all.
You would have
How
to go
you?
With you know, the gold standard for celebrity political endorsements, George Clooney. Also, he has those Casamigos dollars in now, and if I'm going to shake anybody down for a campaign contribution, it's going to be the world's newest minted billionaire.
The Cloons and the Clarks stumping for us. Michael, I'm so sorry to leave this room to go to another room to keep talking with you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's been a pleasure.
It always is, every single day. I'm happy to see you every single day.
Until,
I really am.
Knowing both of us, until the day that we die, because I feel like this show will last forever.
We're gonna die here.
Bury me at 30 Rock.
Bye.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle @LateNightSeth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.